Welcome to the fresh and vibrant airwaves of the Pride and Promotion Podcast. Strap in and turn up the volume because you've landed on the podcast that's setting the bar for the most dynamic and inclusive marketing conversations. Join your host, Joseph Federico, as he prepares to dive into the world of marketing with an inclusive twist where we spotlight the LGBT community and celebrate the power of diversity. Get ready to be motivated as we bring in some of the most influential LGBT entrepreneurs and marketing trailblazers who are reshaping the...
Everybody, I am Joe Federico of J. Federico Marketing and the host of Pride and Promotion Podcast. Welcome to another episode. Today, we have a very special guest, a very talented queer artist, one of my closest friends in the world of literature, Marcus James. Marcus James, please introduce yourself and welcome to the Pride and Promotion Podcast.
Well, first of all, Joseph, thank you for having me.
My pleasure.
I greatly appreciate it. Little bit about me. So, as you said, my name's Marcus James. I guess I would describe myself as a primarily Pacific Northwest Gothic horror author / horror manse or horror romance. So, like, kind of like Poppy Z. Bright. So, like, stuff's gory. I almost said the other word, but I was like, can we use foul language? I wasn't sure. I'm trying to be good. So, a bunch of other stuff. You know, it tends to be gory and creepy and scary, but it's still at the heart always has a romance because, I mean, who doesn't love two boys running off together?
Yes. Sum me up.
I've written 9 novels, and I've contributed to about a dozen or close to a dozen short story anthologies with Allison Books, which RIP, they're no longer around, but they were like the Knopf Random House of queer publishers back in the day. And unfortunately, the recession of 08 decimated, you know, a lot of queer publishers and bookstores. And unfortunately, Allison was one of them. And, but I actually got my first, I guess, start before my first novel came out. I first really got my publishing credits writing mostly gay erotica. So,
yeah,
quite spicy. All my books have sex scenes in them because I believe that, you know, you should take the reader through every aspect of the character's story. Now, I don't believe in throwing sex scenes in for shock, so I never have anything for shock. So one book might have one, another might have 4. It just depends on if it's moving the characters and the story forward and it's natural or organic.
I was just going to say that exactly because we're just going to jump all around, you know, tonight.
But yeah, of course.
I would have to say as somebody, well, first of all, I want to thank you for coming on the show and for allowing me, when I wrote my first book, Voodoo Juice, to allow me to feel more comfortable writing my prose and not just using the community as a shock factor, right?
Right.
And this is even before like social media really kind of blew up, which we can get to in a few moments. But definitely we're all adults here. The sex scenes should move the characters along within the story, not just to put them in for the shock value.
Correct. So. And I will say that one of the things that why I ended up becoming a regular with Allison and their various anthologies is because my challenge is I can't just write like there's a lot of in all the anthologies that I contributed to. There are amazing stories in there that are just really for the sex. Right. Like it's. The story is just about getting to that scene in the alley with the trucker or whatever's going on, right? And then you have to get to me, and I can't just have sex for sex's sake. I just can't. I emotionally don't work that way. There has to be something passionate and intense fueling it. And lust on its own can do that, But when, as a novelist, as a writer, my challenge was, okay, I get like 15, 20 pages available to me. How can I fit an entire novel in 15 to 20 pages? And so whenever you read, whenever you read any of my short stories from Allison, it's like you're walking into a novel that you've been reading, and you just happen to now, today's the day you've picked up the book, and you just happen to now be reading the chapter where the sex scene finally happens between the characters. And so there's complex situations, there's backstory that I give you with every character that's very complex. One of the stories was, one of the ones I'm really proud of, was in Best Gay Erotica, or Ultimate Gay Erotica 2007. And it was about identical brothers, twins, identical twin brothers, adult brothers. So I just want to be clear, they're adults who grew up in Hollywood with like Hollywood parents, very sheltered. And it's an incest story. And it's, and I won an award for it. Like, because it was very, it was very intense. And then another one I did was, I believe in Best Gay Love Stories 2009. And it is about two boys in Missouri, teenage boys in Missouri, who you're like, oh, cute. Like, it's like they're like, they have this romance and they're like, well, what's going on? And then they kill their parents and take off.
Well, you need the intrigue and the murder in these books, right, too, right?
But that's not normal. But then you go, like, to the story before mine, or you go to the story after mine in these anthologies, and then they all just go back to, like, being normal smut. And then, like, there would always be mine. And so I got really known really fast, and luckily at the time I had an agent. I signed with my first agent when I was 19. And, so at the time that I was with Allison, I luckily had an agent. So that became a marketing where it was like, I was a, at the time, what would have been a, you know, a queer outlaw, a queer rebel. It was still very bad. So this would have been like 04, 05, 03, 04, 05. And, you know, it was still very like, queer was still very much a rebellious word to use if you were gay. Like, if you were like, I'm queer, you were like you were an outlaw. You were like, you were punk. You were gonna like, you were gonna fuck up the system in some way. And you were gonna break boundaries. You were gonna be transgressive. And, it's funny to see how that's now, how so homogenized that word has now become. But back when I started, it was a rebellious time to be that word, to say that you were.
But isn't the point, especially now, as, and I myself am a novelist, I'm a social media marketer, I have a television, you know, personality, a podcaster, right? The evolution, the point now as we get older, we are less naive, is to continue, in at least in my opinion, no matter what facet of the community you're a part of or profession, is to be an outlaw, number one. Correct. But I want to go back and tie this back to marketing, because you said something important. Back in 04, 05, 06, 07, 09, there wasn't a lot of social media and marketing. How did you market the books and yourself and getting an agent? I really want to delve into that, because there wasn't a Twitter. So I need to know. I need to know.
All right. So we're gonna hop back into the Marcus James time machine.
We're gonna We
have to go back to before I was even 16 years old. We have to go back to when I was a little kid and was like a natural storyteller. And I came from a very interesting family, and part of that background is Irish, and in that tradition, there's a lot of storytelling. And so I grew up in an environment with, in a family where it was the 80s. My mom was young. She had siblings, my aunts and uncle. They were also young. They hung out with my young, with their cousins, my second cousins, their first cousins, who were also young, like tweens, teens. And it was the 80s. So I grew up in this house where we always had Guns N' Roses playing. We always had horror movies on the VHS. There was just this influence of imagination where you could just be like my mom. We would watch, WWF and WCW because they were separate at the time. And my mom would whip out her lipstick and paint on me and my brother's faces so we could like, and we, it was just one of those times where it was just all young, like kids, and good and bad, a kid. And a bunch of kids, it was almost like we were like the Lost Boys in this crazy way. Even though we had like my aunts and my grandma and my uncle, they were also just like, eh, whatever, like we're all weird and spooky and strange. So I grew up being able to flourish in my imagination. And I originally thought I was in preschool, I was going to be an actor. And so I immediately was like, I'm going to be an actor. And then that lasted all of like, till second grade, and then I saw PBS cooking shows and fell in love with cooking and immediately like became super passionate with that and was like, I'm gonna have a cooking show on PBS. That's my life plan. I'm gonna own three restaurants in downtown Seattle. I'm gonna live above Pike Place Market. Like I had this whole fantasy, and I was still writing, but I would be writing for fun. I wasn't taking it seriously. And then the first real lightning bolt moment was in the fourth grade. I had been saving up for the unabridged Dracula at the Scholastic Library Book Fair.
Yes,
And
those were the best.
right all year.
Go back for adults. So hard.
And I had like saved. And then I buy it and I out my lunchtime, and I go back into my classroom, and my teacher, Mrs. Roseman, who was amazing, it's an amazing woman. She had Lasher, which had just come out, so that was like had been Anne Rice's latest release. R.I.P. I can't. We'll get into how that is happening. that is pivotal in this moment. So Lasher was sitting there, and my teacher says to me, oh, I see you got Dracula. Like, that's such a big book. Are you sure you can, And she was like, but I'm sure you can read it because I was always very much ahead. So I have a learning disability in math and science, pretty bad learning disability. But in arts or in literature, English literature comprehension, composition, when I would get tested every year, and my comprehension in that was always four grades higher than where I was.
I'm not surprised.
Which I guess is why, like, I was so shitty in math and science because I was so good over here. And,
But you found your niche. You found your niche early on and you went with it.
And so she was like, have you ever, she goes, have you ever heard of Anne Rice? And I said, no. Well, that's not true. I had, but peripherally, because like my uncles and my cousins read her. I mean, so she was in my home life, like in my family. I saw her on the shelf, but I was like, Anne Rice. I thought she was like Maeve Binchy at the time. You know what I mean? Like I was just like, whoever. So then she was like, well, you're too young for it, which of course, then I was like, listening. And she was like, but she wrote this novel, Interview with the Vampire. She writes all the things you love. She loves, she, and she goes, an Interview with the Vampire is written from the vampire's point of view. And that is all I ever loved as a child. Like my favorite vampire movies were when you were hanging out with the vampire versus the humans who end up killing the vampire. Like, you get
The
mostly a lot of equal footing, and those were also my favorite. You got like equal time with each. But of course,
Sure.
all I wanted was just to always be with the vampire.
Me
And
too. Me too.
so she was like, you're too young, whatever. I was like 9. We had just moved to this other part of of town, in the same side of town, but a different name part of it, different part of the neighborhood, that there was close to the library. So I could just walk to it literally from home, like walk to the library. So I go do that. As soon as I get home, I get off the school bus And then I go straight to the library. I just don't even drop off my bag. I walk past my house and just keep going to the library. And I go straight to the card catalog, pull up Anne Rice. And they had one copy left, which had just been checked back in. Because at that time, 94, Anne was at the top. So it was like you would have to be on the waiting list for months to check out her. Yeah. Just to check the book out of the library. You could be waiting for, you could be on that thing for months before you could check out one book because everybody was just waiting for a copy. And, you know, you go check other libraries and, of course, other branches were out as well. But they had one that had just got put back on the shelf. I snatched it up, checked it out, and it changed my life in every way, in every way, I will never be able to repay her.
No, and I absolutely understand that 100%.
I was like, holy crap, writing can do that. Like, she made me smell everything in a way no writer had or heard things, felt like just the poetry. And I was like, I want to do this. And
that's your calling.
Yeah. And so from there, I just became obsessed and learned, watched every interview she ever did, really heard her story. I bought her biographies on VHS and her documentaries.
Way before social media.
Yeah.
Way before social media.
Way before. And what she taught me and what I learned was basically how to do it. So I learned you had to go buy Writer's Marketplace, which was this huge, huge book. It was like the size of the Webster Dictionary. And yes, you would go to Barnes & Noble, Borders, whatever. It came out every year. And it was the directory of every agent, publisher, magazine, every fan club, every library, every damn thing that could exist. The contact, it was all there. It was updated every year. And
beautiful book too, yeah.
I just set to sending out query letters, doing
like
the
it was candy. Like
doing the grunt work. Yep, buying the stamps, spending at the time. I would have to drop, you know, I was dropping like half my paychecks on stamps and manila envelopes and printing ink and paper. But that's how I did it. I did it. It was, the internet was, you know, there was LiveJournal and there was MySpace was just starting. And so I was in that in-between time where I got to experience I really got the chance to experience publishing how it had been since the beginning of the publishing industry up until
so many years before.
Right.
But thanks in part to Anne Rice. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. So, you found your calling. You found a new skill. You taught yourself how to become a horror author.
Yeah.
And then you also took part in the query letters and trying to get an agent and getting published way before a Twitter X, a LinkedIn, a Facebook, getting yourself on camera. This was hard work. And I remember working in publishing myself, where we didn't even have we had a marketing team, but a very small team before a MySpace even took off or a Hot or Not or a Facebook or even an Instagram. There was none of that. The job in publishing was to get, you know, act as a publicist and get you the authors out by word of mouth.
Yeah.
There was no social media whatsoever.
It was crazy. Like, you remember when my novel, my second novel, Blackmore, came out in end of 07, or end of 06, early 07? I get it confused because the book, when I wrote it, because it's been planned, like, the whole series has been planned out. So when I wrote it, from how I, so the when I wanted, what year I wanted the series to end, I then had to go back and figure out when it started. So even though it came out at the end of 06, early 07, it was set for the end of for December of 07 going into 08. So sure. I'll confuse when I talk about, because I'll be like, I'll remember when the I'll confuse when the book was set from when it came out. So in end of 06-07 when it came out, I went and spent, I worked a bunch of overtime hours, and I was working in call centers. I've done so much work in call centers, I can't even talk about it. I'm like call, I am like a lifer of call centers. I'm like, people on the phone cannot screw with me. Like, I'm like, I have been there. Just do what I tell you to do. I know you can. Like, I'm not an idiot. But I worked, it was open 24/7. And so you could book overtime hours. So I basically moved in to my job and like only went home to like walk and feed the dogs and spend some time with them and say hi to my partner at the time. And then I would be back at the call center working and sleeping in the break room on intervals and shit to raise money to promote the book. And when it finally came out, one of the things I did was I bought, I can't even remember how, it was like $3,000, but I spent $3,000 on like, I think it was 2.5 or 3 million promotional cards for Blackmore. Like, the national white pages,
right?
And I ran the entire list. And I basically went through the entire alphabet and picked X amount from every state, every major city. And I just figured it out. And then I spent probably like 4 or 5 days filling out and full all of these envelopes and then sending out these promo cards to random people throughout the entire country.
Just to get the word out about the project.
Correct.
So here's a question. Girl, I know you are, and you inspire not only me as, you know, as all these things that I mentioned, but a lot of people in the queer community as well. But here's another question. I love hearing the beginning, right? It's like the old pony trail, right? The old how to get things like down the railroad. Literally, it was like that back then. Yeah. But now that you're continuing to publish works, and I want to get into that in a moment, how do you feel that social media for you specifically, and which platforms, I want the audience to really take note of this, do you promote on now versus how do you feel now versus when you did when you started off without social media whatsoever?
Sure.
I'm assuming, I mean, I know the answer being in this world myself, but we need to hear what's the evolution now that you can utilize all these different free platforms.
So for me, I have found, first of all, technology always eludes me. I am so a child of the 90s. It's not even funny. And this kind of goes back to with my learning disabilities, that technology can just get very frustrating for me. But I'll learn it. I'll fucking learn it. And I do. It's just, it's a hard one. But what I found was, you know, MySpace at the time, and this is kind of the evolution. So MySpace, LiveJournal was going out the door. Everyone was hopping over to MySpace, got to MySpace.
Correct.
That started becoming a little easier, because you could do all the fun things to theme your page and stuff with music. And you could just do all these things that were made it more inviting for people to come to check you out. And then, you know, more people were still reading books at the time. So they would go to the contributors of like the anthologies and there would be like your handle. So then people would go to that. But you couldn't advertise, you know, and then Facebook was still so social. When Facebook first happened, there wasn't even really a way to use Facebook. Like, I remember 07, like 08, 09, Like,
Yep.
there was no, Facebook was still like Animal Farm and people like posting just their family. It was a positive, happy
Sure.
place that I kind of wish we could go back to now. I'm like,
it was.
If
It
only
was,
we had
but
known now.
As far as MySpace is concerned, though, Marcus, I remember you could, drawing it back to how I assist my students, right, and my team now in building personas. It was a great exercise in building personas back on
It
MySpace.
Was.
You're
and that's
talking
what
about
I did. I was
and
able
the
to
skin.
cultivate. I was able to cultivate Marcus James.
Yes.
And,
I was going with that. Exactly.
You know, and that's just, you know, and Marcus James is literally just my first and middle name. That's it.
But that's
but
your brand from the beginning.
Yeah. I just didn't like my, I just, growing up, whenever I got, you know, I said something out of line, I was abrasive, Marcus James. So I always have always associated that kind of as like my rebellious shield. And then I didn't like my actual last name. I just didn't like it. So, there, you know, there's nothing really more behind it other than I just didn't like the sound of it. I didn't like the way it looked on a book. I had like to
right.
write it out.
It right.
So,
yeah.
And then from there, I developed who Marcus James was through, and MySpace was able to do that because I could curate the images. Whenever I did like a racy photo shoot for, I did a racy photo shoot for a magazine in Mexico. And I put one of the images as my background wallpaper of my MySpace page. So you just went in. It was this racy black and white of me and undies and a Burberry polo and all this branded crap. And it was just, you know, it was there. And I could create, and people could then associate who Marcus James was. And especially in the queer, in the queer publishing world and in the queer media world, there is power in our rebellion. There is power.
There always has been, but also
Correct.
Within writing horror,
yes.
writing the monsters
yes.
as well at the same time.
And we, I almost see it as, if you're going to get like theological with it and a Christian, Judeo-Christian view of it, I would say like, you know, the world already sees us as fallen, as damned. So I think when I think of that, I think of Paradise Lost. I think of the rebellion of the angels. I think of, and then I think of, you know, the lithograph illustrations for Paradise Lost and all those beautiful, gorgeous angels falling from heaven, so erotic and tangled in each other. And I have just always seen us as the sacred and the profane. Like, you know, it's like our book convention, Saints and Sinners in New Orleans. Like, we
Yes.
are, there is sacred in the profane, and there is a rebellion in our decadence and our survival. And I've always worn that so proudly, and MySpace helped cultivate that is who Marcus James is. As an author, as an activist,
building your personal brand from the ground up,
right.
really taking a claim to your persona on how you want to be perceived on the internet, that will lead to where you are today.
Yes. And then as soon as I got to, once Facebook really became the thing and it started moving away from being just personal friends and family, cute, but really started
cute, yeah.
allowing for creating, you know, having official fan pages, having things that you could create community with in a way that you couldn't on MySpace. The first thing I did then was, of course, create my official fan page. And that was, you know, back in 11, 12. And,
right.
you know, I was able to ride that Facebook wave of promotion, networking, and then I was able to, when they started allowing for ads, then I started running an ad for my fan page first. So before running ads for books, I would run an ad for my fan page. And then in between, and then usually because I could only afford one or the other, I would then have to switch and run ad for a book. And then
we get a little too at the same time.
When
like that
was
that
done,
time.
Go back to promoting the fan page.
Yeah.
And then once, so now Facebook I've utilized because I have an audience there of a few thousand, but I don't run ads on it anymore. It's a waste of money. No one pays attention. Things don't automatically play. Instagram is really that.
I was just going to get there. And my follow-up question to you, because I love the rebellion as a marketing technique. How do you utilize that now in promoting your newer works? The rebellion as a marketing technique.
Well, I do things like I go on a lot of podcasts. You know, I do a lot of, like, I do book signings. I do a lot of public events. I'm in a lot of, I have been getting, you know, I get featured in magazines here and there, which is nice. But I always make sure, A, that I'm staying on top of, social issues are really important to me. I'm an activist. I've been an activist longer than I've been a writer. I started, helped start Washington State's first ever gay straight alliance. I helped end clinical conversion therapy in Washington State back in, like 2017, 2018. I've just been a lifelong activist and sex positive, especially when it comes to HIV AIDS stigma. I just was affected by it when I was like 8. I was just affected by it as a young kid in a profound way that then made me become very much an advocate for it in my youth and for higher and sex education and sex positivity. And so now on Instagram, the things I do, like, for example, I still have racy pics. And it's nice because it allows you to curate. Instagram allows you to curate your image in a way Facebook and MySpace didn't. We now, of course, have smartphones that work almost as good as professional cameras. You have, you know, selfie sticks now and stands, ring lights. You have all these things where you can now really cultivate and curate your brand and your image in a way that back before that, you had to cross fingers that your publicist booked you with a magazine that's going to send a photographer and, or you're going to get asked to, like, be in a campaign or whatever.
You were at the mercy of somebody else. And now this powerful little device, you could do everything.
Yeah.
And you can literally get shit done on your own faster than you ever could have back in 2007 to 2012 or so.
Yeah. And I never had luck with Twitter. It was just too much to, like, keep up with. Like, it was just like, okay, I'm posting on Facebook. Now I have to go tweet something. And then I have to go make sure I'm taking a picture for my Instagram. I have to go do all these things. And then as time kept going, the amount of time you had to do that in a day increased. And it couldn't just be one picture. It couldn't be just one post. It had to be more and more. And Twitter was just one of those that, like, I would just forget about it. I would forget I had it because Facebook was working so great for me. Instagram was such a relief from Facebook because Facebook had gotten so negative all the time.
A completely different platform at the time. There were two different platforms.
Exactly. Yeah. And so Instagram was just pictures. It was just pictures everywhere. And so I found that I was able to curate an audience and a brand on Instagram better than even Facebook. And then I could promote myself and my day-to-day life and kind of what it means to just be a queer writer and what that looks like. And I could do all that on Instagram in a way that invited more people in.
Your persona while promoting and selling at the same time.
Yeah. What's funny, though, is that it has led to more followers, but not on Instagram. They go follow me on my Facebook. They go to my official fan page and follow that. Which I'm not mad about. I don't base things on, I want you to follow me because you want to, not because, like, you know, I bought it or something. Like, if you want to be my, if you want to follow me, follow me.
In sales for your books, that's also another reason that will eventually lead there.
Exactly. Follow,
and then you build your persona and they will come.
Exactly. And with Instagram, you know, I get to, you know, I get to run ads. I'm a huge fan of ads. Ads are vital. And there's so many great assists out there, like Canva, Clipchamp, like just all these amazing things.
Amazing. Definitely my full recommendation is to invest the $13 a month in the Canva platform, and you're unlocked so many different other avenues in that aspect.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's fun. It's pretty, because the thing is like, it doesn't matter what level of success you are as a writer now. It's changed. The publisher, unless you're a Patterson, unless you're Stephen King, unless you are a huge bankable name.
Hey, Christopher Rice,
you can still be a bestseller. You can still be a bestseller. You could have several books on the New York Times bestseller list. But if you are not that like name, you are having to pay for your own marketing. You are paying for your own promotion. The publisher doesn't do that anymore.
Most people are not even on. I mean, I'm going to call it what it is.
They think the publisher pays for everything still.
My first book with my partner, 2011, we did all our PR and marketing ourselves.
Yeah, you have.
They did not pay. No.
No, it's not what it's not what it was, because for good and bad, things like being able to just self-publish if you want to, without any, and like, I'm not going to crap on self-publishing, indie publishing at all, like at all. My issue with it is I feel like there should have been some gatekeeping in terms of like some, I don't know, some type of validation or acknowledge that you know what you're doing, like,
yeah,
because,
but there's power in that too, power and rebellion in learning the ropes on your own, like we had to do back in the day before marketing was a thing.
But what happened was, and what kind of saturated the industry, the market got super saturated really fast. But you had people who they just wanted people to read their books, so they made them free and made them 99 cents. And what ended up happening is, which again, nothing wrong with that, none of that. But what ended up happening on the traditional end, and this is what people need to understand, is there's two sides to every coin. So as much as, and I'm all about, like, if you want to write a book, you got a story, you get it out there however you want to get it out there. Sell it on the freaking street out of a paper bag. But you have to also understand, though, the cause and effect. So because there's no longer this elite gatekeeping or the literati or whatever that's doing all this and saying who can be published and who can't, and then the market getting so many books oversaturated by indie authors, who so many of them made them free or made them 99 cents, sometimes for 4 or 5 books. It took out the money from the industry. And because people weren't paying the same prices, the same costs for books, publishers to keep up had to lower their prices on digital and and so what ended up happening was that money that the publishing house, again, you know, for good and bad, but they gained all this money. Well, that all left, and that money was used. Okay, we get the big bank authors, and then we can use what's left to promote our mid-level and smaller niche authors. Well, that left. And so then all the money they had to go all to the big people. And so now, unless you're a huge name, and I mean a huge, huge name. So if you're like Donna Tartt, if you're Jodi Picoult, whatever, you're still paying for your book tour. You are paying for your publicity. Your publishing company, they'll do a little, but they're only a little. Maybe
and
a month.
And you're looking on your social media on yourself as well.
Yeah. And
you could very well be missing out, unfortunately, on all of that, getting yourself on Reels, even getting on Twitter X is there's a renaissance still evolving. I'm a big proponent of Twitter X. LinkedIn is a different audience where the money is, and then you have Facebook groups.
Yeah.
And you have all these, you know, questionnaires and polls and everything else in which you can utilize to get the word out about your works. And you should be Gen Pop in general.
Yeah. And I have found that so if you want to go, so it's just you have to understand that, like, authors, it's not the way it was.
No.
You have to be willing to do everything and anything. And you have to be willing to put in the time. You have to learn how to, like I said, I'm not great at technology at all. I had to learn all these programs. Now, people I know come to me and are like, can you make an ad image for me? Can you put together, can you teach me how to put together a trailer? Can you do all this stuff? That's very surprising because I wouldn't have expected that I would have gotten that good at it. But
no,
I was like, this is my life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's you learn how to do it. Yeah.
Or just for those listening, you can also hire a marketing company like J. Federico Marketing to assist, but also teach you in case we part ways to learn how to do it because it is very feasible. It's very affordable, but is well worth it to get your truest story out there.
It's just a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, but it's worth it.
Yeah,
it's worth it at the end because look where you are now. Look where I am. These are beautiful stories that we come from nothing.
Yeah,
especially in the queer community, there's rebellion and power in that too, Marcus.
Exactly. 100%.
Hands down. So unfortunately, we're running out of time. I will definitely have you on 3, 4, 5, 12 more times. I promise in the future of the Pride and Promotion podcast. But as we're running down, wrapping up this amazing episode, can you tell us where we can find your books and find you on all the social platforms, please?
Yes. So you can always find me at marcusjamesbooks.com. And then on social, on Instagram, I'm at marcusjamesauthor. Mm-hmm. My official Facebook is capital M, capital J, A-M-E-S, writer. Yes, writer.
Perfect.
And then I think I'm Marcus James Author on TikTok. That's another one that I'm like, I'm trying. I think
you
I might
to be told.
And then you can obviously find my books literally anywhere, any bookstore, any venue. I prefer bookshop.org. Mm-hmm. You can find all my books on bookshop.org. And that the proceeds from every sale on that site go to keeping open independent bookstores and funding them. Obviously, you can get my stuff on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, whatever, but bookshop.org would be the best place.
Simply amazing. Thank you so much, Marcus James, for coming on the show. Everybody, I'm your host, Joe Federico. This is another episode of Pride and Promotion Podcast, and we'll talk soon. Take care.
And just like that, we're putting the finishing touches on another fabulous episode of the Pride and Promotion Podcast. If today's conversation struck a chord, why not sing our praises with a quick rating and review on your podcast platform of choice? Your support is the spotlight that helps us shine and bring more folks into our ever-expanding audience. And don't forget to hit subscribe. Let's get social too. Follow us online for all the extra goodies, sneak peeks, and continued dialogue about marketing with pride and purpose. Tune in next time as we unfurl more colorful stories, champion the cause of inclusivity, and learn more from the creme de la creme of the industry. Until our paths cross again, keep pushing boundaries, stay true to yourself, and infuse every project with pride.